Coming to you live from the Teaching and Learning Lab studio at UCLA, this is your Brain on Podcast.
Welcome to the Psychology in Action podcast. We're a bunch of graduate students at UCLA who are interested in talking with some of the scientists in the field about their work and helping everybody get a sense of what's actually been going on lately. My name is Ben Rosenberg.
I'm Mark Shasha.
And today we got to talk to Dr. Martin Monti, who recently got a lot of publicity in the last couple years for waking up a comatose patient with ultrasound stimulation.
Yeah, Martin Monti studies wakefulness consciousness. There seems to be two camps of consciousness. Those who study whether or not you're in vegetative state or a coma, they tend to be more medical. And then there's those people who study more perceptual awareness. Those tend to be more philosophers. Martin's in the first group, and he had a lot of interesting topics about consciousness.
Yeah, so we talked through a bunch of different things from consciousness to what it's like to use brain stimulation with comatose patients and maybe how you can even move your brain, so to speak, if you can't move other parts of your body while you're in a comatose state. If you'd like to hear more, you can subscribe to this podcast feed on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or a number of other places. It's also available on the Psychology in Action website.
Hi, I am Martin Monti. I'm a professor in the Department of Psychology and Neurosurgery here at UCLA. And my work focuses on really what makes humans unique, which is our consciousness and the relationship between our mind and the language we speak.
I guess let's start by talking about a broad overview of what consciousness research is like. And one of the big points that we were noticing as we were diving into this literature is there seem to be different definitions of consciousness. So how do you tackle this question of what is consciousness and how does that differ from maybe other approaches?
So I would say that in my lab, we take the definition of a fellow Italian scientist who also works on consciousness, who I think famously said, everybody knows what consciousness is. It's that thing that vanishes when you fall into dreamless sleep and that comes back when you wake up in the morning. Which, of course, I'm sidestepping entirely what your question is, which is what do I mean when I say consciousness? But at least this gives you a feel for what it is what aspect of consciousness we're trying to look at.
And what are some ways that other people might study something that they claim is sort of like the same field of consciousness?
I think because we have no idea what consciousness is, we do have a tendency to break it apart in many different things. Mm-hmm. And one convenient way of breaking it apart is to talk about what people often refer to as transitive versus intransitive consciousness. So much of what I do is intransitive consciousness, which is the question of what does it mean to be conscious? You know, you're here right now, I'm here right now, I'm having experiences. What makes you and me different from when we're completely asleep and dreamless sleep, or maybe when we are under anesthesia or something of that sort? Other people are much more interested in what is the difference between when you see something and it's sort of enters the focus of your attention and it somehow gets represented in your mind and you're aware of it and you can talk of it and you can report on it. And people often talk about that as transitive consciousness. So when you're conscious of something.
Mm.
And of course, these have different traditions and different viewpoints. And I think theories also break down along these two axes most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so sort of like, how do you turn a computer on or off versus how does your computer function in certain contexts or with certain types of things? Does that seem like kind of the distinction there?
I would say that that's the distinction we are imposing on what consciousness is.
Mm.
Now, of course, a really, really interesting question is that actually what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
You know, after all, you know, when your computer turns on, it does certain stuff. It's not just that you're, so that in of itself is a set of processes. Are those fundamentally different from the processes that allow certain computations to undergo? I think is a really interesting question. And ultimately, it'd be nice to know whether, is there such a thing as consciousness in the absence of any type of transitive consciousness? Can you be intransitively consciousness, like have a presence in the absence of nothing, absolutely nothing being sort of transitive consciousness?
Mm.
I think ultimately that might be the question we have to answer, to know if this is just all one big thing or if we've divided it in ways that actually reflect what the nature of the beast is.
Hmm. So to that end, I guess, let's go over some of the major findings in the field. One of the things you've sort of brought up is this question of, are there different levels of consciousness? And you do some work with comatose patients, and how do you differentiate between conscious and unconscious people?
Well, that's a very deep question. And on the one hand, I think we might all agree that sometimes you're conscious, sometimes we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe sometimes we're, you know, dozing off in front of TV, not too conscious. So there might be some level in between. So I think we can agree that there is such a thing as being in or out of consciousness. A slightly different issue is, you know, I can report on that. I can tell you right now I'm perfectly conscious. I'm experiencing what's around me. You can do the same. What I can't do is I can't exactly say with the same confidence that you are experiencing in the same way that I am, right? I have a hard time pointing at someone and saying, yeah, they have exactly what I have. Right? I know I have it. I think you guys might have it, although you could be robots, right? That look like me and act like me. And this leads exactly to the problem that you're talking about. How can you look at someone else without being able to access their feeling of, you know, being here, experiencing what's around them, and tell this person has it or this person does not have it? So in my case in particular, I work with patients who've had severe brain injury. Usually they are in a coma, which I think we agree means they're completely out. It doesn't feel like anything to be in a coma. And some of them just come out of it and live, you know, perfectly healthy lives ever since. Some of them, on the other hand, enter this limbo of conditions known as disorders of consciousness, one of which is the vegetative state, and one is the minimally conscious state, where it's really hard to tell whether they are conscious, to what extent. And there we have to become ingenious into understanding, or at least into finding ways into understanding if someone has that thing, that is consciousness or not. So in our case, in the clinic, if you walked into any hospital and you walked up to a patient in this condition, you would see the doctor performing a set of tests. You know, it might be something like clapping and seeing if their eyes sort of respond or if they startle. You might ask them, you know, look this way, look that way, wave at me, you know, things like that. And usually if someone can do these things, you know, they're conscious, right? If I can look at someone and say, hey, wave at me, and they do, you know, that probably means there's a thinking, you know, there's a being inside there, there's a thinking agent in there. The problem is, what if somebody doesn't do that? Right? You'd be tempted to say, well, they're unconscious, but now you think about it, somebody could not want to wave to you. Somebody could be unable to wave to you because maybe some part of their motor pathway is damaged. Of course, somebody could not wave at you because they are truly unconscious. And we have a hard time telling apart who's not waving or who's not blinking, who's not, you know, communicating because they're out, versus those who would want to communicate. They are, to some extent, in, whatever in might mean, but they can't show that to you, right? And now put yourself in this sort of thought experiment. You come into a room, somebody is lying on a bed, they're perfectly conscious, but they just can't move. They can't move a single muscle. What is ever going to persuade you that they're conscious? Right? That's the problem that we are dealing with.
Yeah, so what can you do? Do you have a solution for that, or do you have a presumed solution to something like that? Is there a way that you can get around that question?
So it'd be great to have a little thermometer we put in somebody's ear, and that'll tell us above 100, you're conscious, below, you're out. That'd be super easy. Unfortunately, we don't have that. We're working on it, but we don't have it. So today, we took one step forward a few years ago now by, instead of requiring somebody to sort of move their hand to say, hey, you know, I'm in here, we'd actually get them to sort of move their brain, you know, quote unquote. So instead of asking someone, look here or look at this object or move your hand or move your foot.
All of those things that require motor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All those things that require motor responses. We just say, think of this one thing and think about it really hard. The typical thing we've been doing is imagine playing tennis. Not that tennis is any special, but it's easy to imagine. And, you know, if I had you close your eyes and imagine playing tennis and I could look into your brain with an MRI, I would see a very specific part of your brain which has to do with motor planning, the pre-SMA, the pre-supplementary motor area, I would see it glowing with activity. As you imagine sequencing motor actions, that part of the brain just gets really interested. So if you can do that, you've got to be conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you can't do that, I'm still, you know, that still didn't help me. Particularly, what if you didn't do that because somehow, because of the geometry of the accident, you lost language?
Mm-hmm.
I can ask you, hey, look at me, wave at me, imagine playing tennis, and you'd have no idea what I'm asking. So I think we took a fundamental step in showing that the standard clinical stuff we do, you know, poking people and get them to respond in ways that mean they're conscious, had a certain limitation, and that was mainly motor. So now we went to their brain, and we can sort of sidestep that, but there's still all these other issues. What if somebody, you know, can't understand us, doesn't have enough cognitive resources? You know, even to imagine playing tennis, you have to kind of do all this top-down effort to engage in imagery, and then you have to stop when I tell you to stop and then restart. It takes a lot of sort of cognitive faculties to do that. So if you lost any one of these, you'd probably be unable to do it. So the next question is, what can we do without having to ask somebody to do anything and just look at the brain and tell, yep, this brain can do it, or nope, that brain can't do it.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a perfect system, but you still can capture more people as being conscious with this tool than you otherwise would be able to. How often does that work? How often do you notice that someone who you might otherwise not be defining as conscious under the prior model, how many people actually get bunched in under this new, with this new tool? Does that happen often?
So I would say that a reasonable estimate, just out of a really quick back on the of the envelope meta-analysis
yeah.
of the work that I know, I would say anywhere from 10 to 30% of patients who today appear unconscious in a standard clinical test might actually have more cognitive faculties that you could tell just by looking at them in a, you know, bedside.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and it's very scary, because now imagine yourself being trapped inside your body with some extent of cognitive faculty. It's unclear how much exact, even if somebody can imagine playing tennis or any, you know, thing of that sort, does that really mean that they have a clear mind, that they're always in the way you and I are in right now? That's unclear. We really don't know. But certainly they can do more than they can show behaviorally. And that is worrisome. But on the other hand, we're getting better and better at detecting them, right?
Which, and you know, the computer's on.
Exactly.
That's cool. So let's transition a little bit to sort of questions of human consciousness as like a unique version of consciousness. So what makes human consciousness different maybe from that of other mammals?
I thought that is a very difficult question to answer. On the one hand, you know, the trivial answer is, well, of course it's different. You know, the type of mental representations of the thoughts that are going on in my mind gotta be different from the thoughts that are going on in a rabbit's mind. I mean, I'm worried with, you know, my professor duties, my teaching, paying the mortgage, my son, and I don't think most bunnies are concerned with that. So from sort of this trivial point of view, yes, of course it's gotta be different. But at that point, maybe we could have grounds to say that your consciousness is different than mine. So a more interesting question is there a fundamental difference between how us human beings sort of experience consciousness and how some other, even just take a non-human primate, right? Is their consciousness, other than the fact that they're thinking, what populates their mind is different than what populates my mind, is it fundamentally any different? I'm tempted to say that in animals that are close to us, it can't be fundamentally different. And the reason I think that is because the neural circuitry is bound to be extremely similar to ours. Once you start changing the neural circuitry, then at that point, I'm willing to admit in a more profound sense that consciousness has got to be very different. By the same token, I'll admit that it is perfectly conceivable, and this depends on which theory you believe, that you could create a computer that has the exact same properties as you're in my brain, and it should feel like something to have that brain, to have to be that computer. In fact, it should feel not too different than what it feels to be you and me.
So a lot of your research also works with brain stimulation methods. And I'm wondering, is there a way that you can sort of jumpstart consciousness? Is that possible?
Yeah, so we've been working on this for a while. And the premise is that consciousness is not quite aware, but is a how. So there isn't quite a spot of the brain, and that's it. That's the conscious spot, and those five neurons kind of bring it all into being. I think a more productive way of thinking about it is consciousness emerges from how the brain functions and how different parts of the brain sort of talk to each other. Turns out there's one piece of the brain, the thalamus, that is really crucial for enabling this the type of chatter that leads to consciousness. So if consciousness is a how rather than a where, we can try to stimulate certain parts of the brain, the thalamus, which seem to be so important for that how to take place. And so we've been using ultrasound to try to, by injecting sort of energy and vibrations really, to try to restart the thalamus, which we know is not very active in these patients, and try to get it to work again, try to sort of, you know, as you said, to jumpstart it back into function. And there is some initial evidence that actually we can do that, and patients do benefit in a measurable way, meaning they can do more than they did before after we stimulate them a couple times. You know, this evidence, of course, is preliminary, and until we've acquired much more data, we'll be cautious. Much of this could just be spontaneous recovery, or just serendipitously we happen to have stimulated them just when they were spontaneously recovering, which is perfectly possible. Maybe we could have just sang them a nice song and the same would have happened.
So I want to interject there a little bit. What is it like to have what is objectively a really interesting possible phenomenon that you've discovered and have that scientific integrity in the back of your mind that says we have to pump the brakes? Here are all the reasons why this might not be working. But in your mind, you're thinking there's all this scientific evidence to back it up. This is a really cool thing. I just want to shout it from the rooftops that this would be so, so cool. What is it like to be sitting in that situation?
I am mostly just trying not to embarrass myself. sort of that's my principal preoccupation. I'll say it's fun, and it there's so much that goes on into a modern academics, and not all of it is as much fun as I was told when I signed up for this at the very beginning. It's fun to get this excitement from other people, to feel this excitement. At the same time, I find it fun to say, no, this is great, but let's just hold on one second. Let's do it this other way and see if it still works. And you know what? Let's try it this way. And if we do it here, then and it still works, then yeah, it's got to be us, right? We really are doing it. And even if it pans out the worst way possible, you know, we do all these experiments. Turns out it was just not us. Look, we've given it a good shot. We've been careful. It's totally reasonable what we're doing. There are reasons for doing it. The rest, nature will decide if this is good or not. And that, in of itself, I find very sort of that's the fun part of it.
Yeah, that's cool. So you're pointing to now this specific part of the brain that has at least an important role in consciousness. But do you think that there's a way that you can reverse engineer consciousness as a whole, or is it this sort of emergent phenomenon that arises from the interaction of so many different things that it's impossible to really decompose it and put it back together again?
I will say that the reductionist in me says there's no reason we shouldn't be able to perfectly understand it in all of its glorious detail, the same way that there's no reason we shouldn't understand in all of its glorious detail how the human mind, you know, represents the visual world out there, which turns out to be an extremely complicated thing, which computers still have a hard time doing. So my reductionist self says, yeah, absolutely. How we can do that is a whole different ballpark. I think we've tried for many, many years to sort of squeeze consciousness out of the brain, words of my colleague and friend Giulio Tononi, meaning we've been trying to like show the brain and put the brain in conscious and unconscious state and squeeze out of that what makes consciousness. And that just didn't bring us as far as I thought it would have. So the new approach, which I sort of partake in, even if sort of with limited affiliation, is more, let's try to think of what consciousness as a system should be and what properties does the system that has the things that you and I experience, for example, you know, having a unitary experience, that's clearly part of our consciousness, is that it all feels like one giant experience, right? You're not experiencing the colors and the sounds separately. They kind of come in to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a profitable way, which people are exploring today, is can we start from this point of view, what it feels to be conscious, and think of what does a system need in order to sort of generate these feelings? And, you know, time will tell whether, you know, this is any better than the current more neuroscience-y approach.
So that's interesting, because a lot of the way that reductionism might be taught to people is you take like a watch, for instance, and if you take all of its pieces apart, you should still be able to rebuild the watch exactly the same way. I think that's a debate that sort of pervades across a lot of different psychological disciplines, is how much is psychology as a field really a reductionist field, and how much is it, by the nature of it being a study of individual differences, a thing that's not really a reductionist style, that or a reductionist style wouldn't really fit well. How does that jive with what you're saying about from a neuroscientist perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, if I were, you know, taking the other side of this, I'd say, yeah, you deconstruct the watch and you put it back and you understand every single piece. Have you understood anything about time? By doing this exercise. And you might say, well, yes, I've understood that time is, you know, is an oscillation, is has a periodicity to it, has certain properties. I think that's where the question of reductionism really becomes important. And you can, people have, you know, spoken about sort of thought experiments. You know, you could take somebody famously who doesn't know anything about color, right? They're born with achromatopsia. And they read books and books and books, and all the glorious detail of the brain does color, what does color mean, the wavelengths, how those map onto our labels. And then suddenly, by magic, they regain, you know, their V4, part of the brain that seems to care a lot about color. And now the world is in color. Have they learned anything on top of everything they already knew of all the glorious detail? Which is the question I asked you earlier about the watch and time. And some people would say, impossible. There's something that, you know, experiencing color, you'll never know that from understanding the reductionist, sort of from taking the reductionist stance. On the other hand, there is a possibility that when we say, oh, experiencing color is, you know, you've learned something completely different, there could be a chance that when we say experiencing color, it's nothing else than all that glorious detail we were talking about, you know, certain neurons doing certain things, plus your body being in a certain state. So it could reduce, in my opinion, to something very boring, such as what you say, that glorious experience of color that you can extract from a book, is nothing other than your brain doing its thing, and at the same time receiving input from your proprioceptive system that you're upset or you're happy, or you're sort of, it could just be a blend of a very sort of boring neurons doing their things and other information coming in at the same time. And we've learned to call that experience, but maybe it's just nothing else than this sort of coalition of different inputs.
Hmm.
You know, again, time will tell.
Yeah. So I'd like to transition a little bit again. You teach a lot about some of the common neuroimaging methods in cognitive neuroscience. They're really applicable to a broad array of topics. What are your thoughts, though, on some of the way that these tools can be used, either well or maybe less well, and how that relates to the current replication crisis that psychology and cognitive neuroscience are especially experiencing recently?
Yeah, so every tool can be used for good and for bad. So that notwithstanding, I think it's slightly more complicated in the sense, I think we're in crisis over whether we are in crisis. I've read with a lot of interest, it's not exactly my field, but I've read with a lot of interest the efforts to replicate things. And some efforts have been marketed as being exact replications, but if not. I remember there was one experiment was about perception of U.S. politicians, which had been originally done in U.S. students, but it was replicated in Holland, if I remember correctly. And what on earth do they know about? I mean, in today's world, maybe they know every single tweet of our president. But sort of there are so many more layers to this that I think we're in crisis over whether we are in crisis. On top of it, there's another thing that people are underplaying, which is that many of these phenomena are not stable over time. There are some effects that, you know, we learn. Now I teach them in Psych 101, and my students know about them, and obviously the phenomena don't pan out because we've taught them. And so, you know, now they don't pan out. So the discussion is so much richer than just, is there a replication crisis? There are so many aspects to it. Undoubtedly, methodology is playing a big part in this, in the sense, over time, we get better and better at doing what we do. And looking back, a lot of the things we used to do seem silly now. I remember experiments with four experiments using MRI, fMRI, with four people in them, with conclusions and discussion about what this meant about you and me and everybody else that has a brain. And I think they were insane. This is, you know, this can't be true, right? Four people are not representative. So on the one hand, yeah, definitely, our methods are getting better by the second. We get smarter by the second about how to do things. So undoubtedly, things that we might have thought were true was based on bad methodology, and we're slowly getting better and better and better. On the other hand, we are not observing a static system. Right? The system we're observing is clearly changing over time. As I said, even just because I now teach in Psych 101, those basic phenomena that, you know, we've spoken about for a long time, so my students know about them, so when we test them on them, obviously it's a different beast than those we've tested way back. So every tool can be used for good or bad. We start not knowing how to use it at all. We slowly progress to using it better and better. fMRI is a beautiful example of this. A lot has been said and published, and I don't know how good all of it is. But we are, as a field, getting way better. Sometimes we our laundry gets aired sort of more, or the laundry gets aired more or less publicly. And sometimes it's great, so we all learn sort of very quickly that what we've been doing was completely wrong. But I think this is the nature of science. You know, trial and error, just get better and better and better and keep going.
So I'm really interested in this because I think it speaks to a broader issue about studying psychology generally. Because if I take my pen and I lift it and I drop it once, that has no effect on whether or not the next time I let go, it's going to fall. Every time I drop it, it's going to fall, right? And in psychology, what happens potentially is that as people learn about psychological phenomena and draw really elegant conclusions from them, and that conclusions disseminated into the world, that changes the phenomenon that you were studying, or it can change that phenomenon. So I'm just really interested in this idea that we're measuring sort of a moving window of something, and how does that impact the way that research is conducted in psychology compared to other scientific fields?
Absolutely. You could explain to the pen why it's falling, and it would still fall, right? Now, part of this is true for the human brain. There are certain things that, you know, certain visual illusions and or perception of depth. Those, I can explain them to you 100 times in glorious detail of why they're the way they are. You're still going to perceive them that way. There's just nothing you can do about it. So on the one hand, there are some phenomena in the human brain that are more akin to natural, you know, to sort of the natural sciences, where things don't quite move in the same way. And I think this has to do mostly with the lower end, that automatic lower end of the human mind. All that stuff that happens without you having to worry about it, recognizing an object for what it is, and that sort of things. Once you get into the higher end, so once your consciousness starts playing starts playing a role in what's going on in your mind, then you're absolutely right. It's a moving target. And I mean, you know, of course, it should be that way. I mean, it's great that it's that way, right? We are gaining more knowledge, we're understanding more, and as we understand more, our perspective on things change. And of course, you as a scientist, you come to me and you probe my perspective, it's bound to change over time, right? As a population, as an individual, it's bound to change over time, even just because we explain these things in Psych 101. I sometimes have a hard time replicating some effects in class because I've already given away, or some other class has already given away how this works. So my students know I'm trying to trick them into something, and they don't get tricked quite as much as before. You know, there are a lot of aspects to the replication crisis, right? So some, sure, bad methodology, which we're with time getting better. Some must have to do with the fact that the human mind, to some extent, is a moving target and changes over time. And some might well be that what we publish is presumably just a fraction of the studies that are being made, and we publish those that are significant, so the so-called file drawer problem. So maybe what we really need is there should be a website online called filedrawer.com or .edu. And anybody who does a study that just doesn't pan out, they upload it anonymously. We don't need to know who they are. We won't shame them. We won't point fingers. something where, you know, the methods are clearly explained, the results are clearly explained, but something that anybody can browse and say, yep, they tried it, it didn't pan out. Let's add that to our sort of mental meta-analysis of everything that's out there.
That would be really interesting. I think that there would be a lot of things in there, first of all. But second of all, it would be really helpful because a lot of people are chasing down a lot of rabbit holes that are not going to be fruitful because they don't know what's already been tried and failed, right?
Absolutely. In fact, we go down rabbit holes because, yeah, nobody's published this. It's a great idea. And maybe other five people tried it and it just didn't work out. And of course, the problem is that when something doesn't work out, you know, you gotta find out why. That's not always straightforward. It could be because nature is just saying no. It could be because they use the wrong, you know, inter-trial stimulus. It could be because of many things. But at least we'd have a record of what people have tried. And you know what? My next idea, I could browse on this website, you know, by keywords, see if somebody's done something similar. At least I would know that, you know, if you do it this way, it didn't pan out. So there's got to be something wrong in there. Let me think about how I'm going to do it.
Yeah. So consciousness is a topic that people discuss in and outside of science. What are some of the best books out there that talk about issues of consciousness in really any context?
I would think there are three books that come to mind. And two of them come from who I consider the foremost scientists in the field. One comes from Stanislas Dehaene, which I think is simply titled Consciousness. And it's a very scientifically oriented review of evidence that exists out there for why certain things enter our mind and we sort of take possession of them and we know they're there and we can think about them, talk about them. There's a second book by who I consider to be the other big contender in this field, which is Giulio Tononi. And I think they call this title Phi, where Phi being the measure by which he measures consciousness. So it's sort of from this point of view, it's more of a Phi is a measure that says whether an architecture is able to support consciousness. I find that book to be more of a philosophical treaty. It's more of a point of view. Of course, it goes into a lot of the detail of this theory, but as opposed to being an overview of all these experiments, it's more of a philosophical position with science to it. And finally, a book that I like a lot because it touches the difficult issues of my particular field, which is called Rights Come to Mind by Joe Finns. And this is a book about the ethical implications of studying consciousness, particularly within patients who, you know, are in a limbo and are at the boundary between being conscious and being unconscious. What does it mean as a society? What rights are we willing to grant to somebody who lives in this at this boundary? What rights should they have? What rights is it reasonable to give them? And if somebody can imagine playing tennis, what does it mean? Should we ask them, do you want more analgesics? Are you feeling in pain? It goes into these very difficult questions, which I think as a society, you know, this is when my area of experience, so things leave the desk of Professor Monti and go into sort of the societal discussion and sort of broader discussion. So these to me are the three books that I, in the domain of consciousness, I would point to if anybody who's interested in reading them. These give a beautiful overview of what's happening.
And so where do you see the field going now? Where do you see consciousness and cognitive neuroscience blending together and moving forward from sort of your own perspective? Where do you think the field's going? Because there are a lot of possibilities, but you probably have a pretty interesting insider's view to that too.
I think I've seen the field get into smaller and smaller sort of almost ramify and split into all these different sub aspects of consciousness. And we're getting very good at these small sub aspects. We're getting very good at understanding what does it mean, how quickly can you show something for it to be available to somebody's representations in a way that you can talk about it and report about it. We're getting very good at understanding the details of what kind of circuitry do you need or just how much function is necessary to be considered in versus out and where does that happen. What I really desperately need the field to do is to step out from this detail and to sort of bring it back together and address the real questions, such as, you know, does it mean anything when I say it feels like something to be me? Is that anything other than a collection of neurons, as I was explaining earlier? Is there any other that, you know, whatever is making up this one moment in time? Questions such as, can the mind have consciousness in the absence of any, you know, transitive consciousness? Mm. Is my feeling of I'm here right now, is that fundamentally different from the things that I'm conscious on? I think these are the big questions that we really have to go towards. I'd really want the discussion to be at a much broader and thicker level. Of course, science today is very reductionist in certain ways, and in order to publish, and to we need to make very carefully controlled experiments. It's great for the science to be going that way, but I think it needs to go hand in hand with a much broader and deeper discussion about consciousness.
Mm-hmm. So you must have a lot of good advice for aspiring scientists really in any field, particularly in psychology, but in science generally. What are some of the things that either you've heard over the years that really helped direct your own work, or things that you've seen work for other people? What are some of the things you would tell an aspiring young scientist who's just starting out now?
I will use Steve Jobs' words, stay young and stay foolish, stay hungry. What I mean is that for forces that are obviously beyond me, science is becoming very industrialized in the sense, you know, we almost produce a product, which is papers. And there's a lot of pressures to do more and more of them, and there's a lot of pressure to publish, and there are industries that are based upon what we do. I feel the incentives are to churn out things as opposed to think, to follow big questions. And while it's great that there's a mechanism, there's an industry there to allow us to communicate what we find, which is necessary, I also think it's creating pressures that might not necessarily be what we want, particularly for young students who find themselves having to have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on your field, number of publications by time point X. I think we're sort of leaving the big discussion a little bit in the background. And I think nobody should ever forget what is the real question, what they're really after. It's such a dream job. It's such a beautiful, beautiful job to do, to be in science. You get to, you know, ask questions that are deep. You get to chase questions. But I have a fear that we're getting lost in just the practicalities of having to meet certain things and having to sort of abide by certain pressures, which, as I said, on the one hand, it's great that they're there. But on the other hand, nobody should ever forget that the reason you signed on for this, it's because you have some burning questions you want to answer.
I think that's really good advice. This has been really, really interesting. This has been a fascinating discussion, and we really appreciate you coming on to discuss it with us. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to talk about before we close?
Well, how are we going to solve consciousness in the next 20 minutes?
If you have the answer, please tell me. I don't know.
That'll be for next time.
Okay, yeah, for next time we'll have you back on, and we can talk about that in maybe, I don't know, 2-3 months when you've solved it, you let us know, okay?
Let's say 4.
4 months. Okay, 4 months, we'll call you, okay?
All right, thanks.
Thanks again for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
If you like this podcast, remember that you can subscribe to it on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, or you can find us at the Psychology in Action website or by searching for Psychology in Action on Google.